So, we're going to talk about informed consent, and we're going to think about it both classically, as it's talked about in the literature with Beecham and Childress. They are the people most famous for laying out what informed consent looks like theoretically and what its pitfalls and caveats are. They argue that there are four elements of disclosure of informed consent: disclosure, understanding, voluntariness, and confidence. We'll look at each of those four elements and look to see how can we understand informed consent as what we might call problematized, become problematic, not straightforward, not easy to achieve, because on the face of it, and that comes as a surprise to many folks when they first think about informed consent, because it sounds like it must be a very straightforward and very simple process. When you look at these four elements, you come to see that it is anything but straightforward and complicated in all kinds of ways. And then we're going to look at the famous article by Veitch, who is a philosopher doctor type at Georgetown, who wrote the piece about informed consent being authoritarian. It's got a reputation for being anything but authoritarian. It's supposed to be patient, empowering, not authoritarian, because it is supposed to give the choice about treatment options or various pathways that one could take, or the management of one's health care, into the hands of patients. And Veitch, in this ironic way, argues that it is actually not empowering. It's actually giving over power to clinicians. And we'll talk about some of his central concepts there, how the informed consent has two competing conceptions of the good, the patients and the doctors, that are in conflict or at issue. He goes so far as to think that that's a real conflict of interest, and we'll talk about how could you have a conflict of interest between the physician and the patient, what kind of conflict of interest when it comes to informed consent, especially because we don't tend to think that conflict of interest could rear its ugly head in this context, because we think that the doctor wouldn't have anything, or the nurse practitioner, whoever, the provider, wouldn't have anything at stake in what you actually end up deciding. And then we'll look at some examples of where one particular person's belief or values would very much impact what treatment decisions that person would make, and how if you were a clinician with opposite, opposing, conflicting values or beliefs, it would lead you to different treatment considerations, and how that might influence the way that informed consent is actually done as a process. And finally, we'll think about Veitch's suggestion that we might be able to overcome this if we could cluster ourselves in value communities where what I care about and what you care about are so overlapping that we don't have to worry about the gulf between us in terms of our conceptions of what's important, but we would actually automatically be on the same page, and that could influence what kind of information is both given and received, and therefore what kind of choices are made. So that is our agenda. Alrighty, it's going to be every man on board today, because this is a highly participatory session, and there are not many to participate. So the first question, when we think about disclosure, the first element of informed consent, disclosure, is the direction of information that comes from the provider to the patient. That seems very simple, because it looks like there's just a fact of the matter, and all the provider has to do is convey that fact of the matter to the patient, and then the disclosure obligation, the part of informed consent that is the direction of provider to patient, has then been met. But it actually turns out that I know we're very small, right? It actually turns out that that what is disclosed, what gets chosen to be disclosed, is very complex. So tell me, what are the kind of things that providers would or should disclose under the rubric of this first element, under this label? What is it that clinicians are supposed to disclose?
Mm-hmm. Risk.
Okay, the risk of what?
Any complications that, say, if they were doing a procedure, might occur.
All right, so any of the risks of the treatment. Okay, what are the risks? So in the risk of the treatment, it's the risk of the treatment, I imagine, itself, especially if there's just one. What if there isn't just one?
But like, and while administering the treatment, let's say you were performing surgery.
Yeah, so the risk of the treatment itself, let's say it's surgery, or it could be a drug that's being given, or some kind of other therapy. Okay, what other risks besides the risk of treatment?
Effectiveness.
Okay.
Potential, I guess the other side would be failure rate.
All right, the effectiveness, failure rate. Okay.
I mean, if you're talking about like a study, the risk of confidentiality, like that.
All right. Confidentiality breaches or risks. That's under risks. Okay. What else? We don't have to just leave ourselves to risk.
But I'm also in risk of not giving the treatment.
Yeah. Okay. Not getting the treatment. Good. What else? Now let's not think of ourselves as limited to the kind of informed consent process that happens when there is a particular treatment in front of someone. Like before a surgical procedure, they will give you a sheet of paper, someone will come up to you, it'll already be sort of stock for that. Let's say it's an endoscopy. They'll have the risks of the endoscopy, they bring it to you, they circle which ones they think are more important, and they go over it, and then they get you to sign it. And that is a very constrained and limited part of informed consent. But we want our discussion today to be broader, to be thinking about just the way that you would have a dialogue, for example, when a provider and a patient were trying to decide which path to go down. So we don't even have to be near a procedure.
So even like the purpose of it.
Okay.
The wanted outcome is of it.
Okay. Purpose, the outcomes.
Who this information will be, like who will be using this information.
All right, so it's kind of like the same thing about the confidentiality. I mean, and also if you're thinking about it in a research protocol, that would be information, but if you're in a treatment setting, what information?
Oh, for treatment?
Yeah.
I guess this would go with confidentiality, but any other practitioners that would be involved, like.
Okay, so if I were saying to you, your choices as I see them are to have bypass surgery or medical management. Information, what in that kind of a dialogue are you interested in me putting on the board? What aspect are you thinking of there?
I was thinking of a completely different scenario.
Give me one, so I understand, because that's why I wasn't able to hook it up yet.
Okay, for example, in undergrad, I did some research, and the PI was involved, had a little bit of a conflict of interest with some other, he sat on the board of some company.
Yes, so for research. So let's, research, I agree with you. Let's limit our discussion today to just the clinical, so that now we're not in a research protocol at all. We're only talking about clinical conversation, because it's hard, you're right. You have to add certain types of issues of confidentiality and why are you doing this and all that if you go down the path of informed consent in a research protocol. But what you might think is that in a dyadic relationship between patient and provider, it would be that much more simple than in research. So I want the take-home message today to be to show how, with best intentions on both parties, informed consent is actually anything but simple. So let's leave the most complex case out, which would be research, because you're actually doing something for your body that may not actually be therapeutically valuable for your body, and let's talk only about the kind of conversations where it is you that's of interest, because you're the patient, or it's your patient and it's of interest to you because you are the clinician, but this is a therapeutic clinical setting. So confidentiality and risk are probably more in the idea of research. So you don't usually have somebody who would say, I think your choices before you are medical management or bypass surgery. I swear I won't tell anyone. You don't usually have that part of an informed consent dialogue. Okay?
This goes all the other treatment options.
Yes, all the alternatives. Good.
Costs of treatment.
Oh, right. Great.
Uncertainties.
Things okay, yes.
Provider.
Great. what we're going to do after we build this list is I want you to go through them, and I want you to tell me how, putting all that up there, first of all, this would be the best informed consent conversation that ever occurred, you know, in the world, and never will be repeated again. This is so thorough. But even so, let's imagine we could. Show me how, take one of these elements and show me how it's actually problematic, how it's difficult to achieve, how it is not straightforward. Because let me tell you the starting point here. It sometimes appears to people that in medicine, there is just a fact of the matter. And to a certain extent, there is a fact of the matter. I mean, you either have, let's say, a hole in your heart, let's use my son's example, an ASD, or you don't. It's a fact of the matter. He had an atrial septal defect. When he was two, it was surgically addressed and whatever. He's much older than that now. It doesn't matter. Point is, you either do have a hole or you don't. My guess is most of you don't. Maybe none of you do. He did. Fact of the matter. So you might say, given that it is an actual fact of the matter, not in dispute with his mom, his dad, the surgeon, the cardiologist who is doing the echo, his regular cardiologist, his pediatrician, no one disputed that he had a hole in the heart. How complex could an informed consent discussion actually be, given that there is a clear fact of the matter? So now we want to problematize each one of these, though, to show that even if there is that level of fact of the matter, the kind of information that is given actually is fully infused with the value perspective, judgment, prejudice, opinion, training, experience, background of the person giving out the information, even about something as straightforward as is there a hole or there's not, which is without dispute among any of the parties. How could it be so problematic then? How could it not just be a simple piece of a simple dialogue or a simple monologue even? Show me how, just using something like that hole in the heart, how could it be the case that this conversation could be complex and could be shaded, could be molded, is shaped by the very lens through which the provider looks? How?
The type of knowledge that the provider has access to with regard to reimbursement rates.
Let's take this one. There was a study at that time that had come out that showed that children who went on bypass, which is what you have to do if they're going to crack your chest, open up your heart, and sew up the hole, they're going to have to put you on bypass. There was a piece of research that had just come out that showed that children who were on bypass, even for a very short amount of time, had a 10-point deficit in IQ by being put on bypass. The person that I was talking to, the cardiologist, did not know about this piece of research, which was not in a journal for hysterical mothers, but the journal Cardiology, in a very mainstream journal. So that person, not knowing that piece of research, me as a mother knowing that piece of research, we are going to be in a problematic situation because, of course, I'm going to have a piece of research. That person's not going to have a piece of research. And what's going to follow from there? What do you think your typical situation would be in a scenario like that?
You're going to lose trust in that clinician.
I might lose trust. And what happens on the clinical side?
I was going to say that you would think that there's a higher risk, but maybe... I was going to say you would have different values of risk.
Okay, so that is true. Okay, yes. So, for example, we may not be on the same page about what the risk is. So the risk, for example, if you're just talking about something like the bypass itself and you don't have this study, and let's say this study isn't true at all, then you are talking about a fairly low risk from simply the anesthesia. This is a pretty simple operation when it's this type of a hole. So otherwise, without this confounding piece of information, she might be working on one risk assessment and I might be working on another. But in this dialogue of me having a piece of research that I'm bringing to a clinical provider who doesn't actually have this piece of research, your typical dynamic will be what?
Well, the clinician may be defensive.
Yeah, it's going to be dismissive, defensive. Oh, everybody comes in with this small piece of information. The internet's, you know, ruining my life, you know, whatever. Right, exactly. Okay, good. So your argument was, depending on the information one has as a provider, one might have different types of information or pieces disclosed. Okay, what else? Pick something else up here as well. Show me how else. Anything.
effectiveness of failure rates.
Okay, tell me that.
Like if it's a fairly new procedure, then we really know what the failure rate is like.
All right, and if they did, they might not disclose it.
Yeah.
In other words, while a patient might, or a patient's family might want to have that piece of information, that may not be a piece of information you want to give. So in your spiel about what you're giving to the patient or family, you may not include the failure rate. In fact, is it the case that some patients will want that information and others will not? Surely. Surely it's the case. So now we actually think about how complex we've even gotten it on one dimension. There's a piece of information you absolutely know. Let's say you do. Let's not say it's new. Let's use your other example. It is known. But the problem is you don't know whether I am going to be interested in that piece of information or not. And it actually isn't even dependent just on the person. It's dependent on which type of information. Let me give you an example. If there's a surgery you have to have, you may not want to know that 1 in a million people will die while they're under anesthesia. You just may not want that piece of information because it's frightening and that fear won't change your mind because what you have to do is what you have to do. And so you might actually resent having that worry added to your plate when there's really no choice of the matter. It's not like you could say, well, with a 1 in a million chance, I think I better get my affairs in order, or I think I better say goodbye to my mother-in-law, or what are you gonna do with a 1 in a million? So you might just feel like you just burdened me. On the other hand, you could have a patient who said, you told me there were no risks in anesthesia, and there's actually a 1 in 100,000, or 1 in 500,000, or 1 in a million. You didn't give me a piece of information I absolutely would have wanted to have. Unfortunately, the way that we figure out that we have given either too much or too little information is by having stepped in it, not by knowing a priori who am I talking to and what would that person want. So even on that piece right there, the burden on the person giving out the information is that you gotta actually guess right, because if you undergive, you get accused, and if you overgive, you get accused, and yet you're sort of shooting in the dark here. Okay, what else from the where you might have a discrepancy, Olivia?
You, along the same effectiveness rate, you could frame the way you frame information, so
yes, it has 10%
exactly chance that it will, you know, work versus a 90% chance that it won't work.
That's right.
How couch that people's decisions differently.
Right. So the way that I frame what the risks, the benefits, how therapeutic, how much efficacy, how much confidence I have in the thing that I'm offering to the patient is very much a lens that is very much contingent on the lens I have. And that's through all kinds of things, like how risk-averse I am and how much success I have and how much confidence I have in my abilities and all kinds of things, right? But then the way that I frame it, it's not just what I'm actually saying. It's not even that I'm giving a piece of information, let's say a 90-10 split or a 99-1 split or even a 50-50 split. It's the way that I frame it has everything to do with the way it's going to be heard. So I can minimize the risk by the way I frame it, or I can highlight and amplify the risk the way that I frame it. This gets to the idea of conflict of interest that we'll talk about at the end of class. But that will have spectacular influence on the way that this information is assessed. So give me a framing that would illustrate this. Show me how that could work. Tell me how you could say something one way or say it another way, but you're talking about the same fact, and yet it's not going to come across in the same way.
Your chances of dying as a result of this procedure are 95%. Your chances of dying from this procedure are 95%.
I see. So you're even using the same sentence with different inflection.
I said use the same words.
Doesn't matter. You could.
Same facts. Okay.
Well, the same facts. It doesn't matter. I mean, your point is the same. You could. It's true that you could use the exact same sentence and put a different inflection on it. How about if you're using the same split?
Or you could say 5% chance of success and
right.
life.
And much more likely, you've got a 95% chance that this is going to absolutely nail it. Or, well, I've got to tell you, there is a 5% chance that you could die. Very different sentences, but it's actually the same fact. And so, when it comes to disclosure, even of the same fact, what the lens is that you are viewing the information through has everything to do with what you're actually saying. Okay, what else? Mm-hmm.
think in terms of alternatives, a physician may only present alternatives they themselves think are realistic or reasonable. And
absolutely.
So, for instance, like if there was some, you know, non-traditional alternative medicine, they might not present that as an option because that's not something that they would do.
Exactly. So let's you could imagine. Let's imagine that in your practice, you believe that someone ought not to go beyond, and then pick your week, 41 weeks gestation. So at 41 weeks gestation, you say, we could do a C-section at the end of the 41st week, or we could induce you at the end of the 41st week, but you don't actually give the option of, we could wait and see for another week. Which, if you're a midwife and a healthy pregnancy, you may very well say, let's just give it another week. But that's not an option you actually put on the table. Not because you're trying to do hanky-panky or whatever. It's because it is not a viable option for you. But here's the rub. What isn't a viable option for you isn't necessarily what is a viable option for no one. Because so much of medicine is actually localized. If you've ever seen some of those very interesting studies that'll tell you where you're much more likely to get a bypass in the United States versus medical management, versus drug management, and it's not just about who can pay and what kind of resources there are. There are actually regional differences, so that no matter what class you're in, if you're in North Carolina, no matter what class you're in, if you're in New York, your odds of having bypass be the thing that's pushed in the same exact situation of your heart will be very different. And interestingly too, regions of the country don't know about each other. So, for example, take two blockbuster hospitals. Take HUP and take Brigham and Women's. Brigham and Women's is a Harvard teaching hospital, and HUP is one of Penn's, obviously. At Brigham and Women's, it is standard that every IV, before an IV, gets lidocaine. And it is standard at HUP that they have never in their life, heard of anyone who would ever do something as crazy as give lidocaine before an IV. Except we're talking Harvard versus Penn. And they've never heard of each other. At Brigham, they would not, and they'd be amazed that you would actually surrender your veins to have an IV without lidocaine. And at HUP, they can't imagine that anybody would give two shots. Same with an amnio. In an amnio, at HUP, no one would ever give any lidocaine because they say you get one shot for the lidocaine and one shot basically is the amnio, is the needle for the amnio. Why would you want to have two needle sticks? Why don't you just have one needle stick? You're still getting a needle stick. Standard of care in most places is you give lidocaine before an amnio. But they would not know that of each other. And when you would say, because let's say you had an amnio in one part of the country, so you're now getting an amnio in another part of the country, and you'd actually say, oh, well, how come you're not doing such and such? They would look at you like, well, you must be batty. I don't know where you would have gotten that information. Absolutely nobody would ever do it like that. So medical information is colored also even by region, and what options aren't going to get on the table isn't just because they'd be crazy options. It's because they're not understood as viable options in the locality where that's being practiced. So when you talk about all the alternatives, it can even be considered in the same domain, tertiary care center, to be viable in one place and not in another, let alone all therapies that might be understood as valuable but are not part of the same training set. So for example, allopathic clinicians are not trained in acupuncture. But some centers might say, you know what, I had heard that acupuncture might be good for this. And others might be like, acupuncture, I'm not even putting that on the table. So it's in both domains, either where it is part of standard of care inside one disciplinary practice and where there is disputes across disciplinary practices. All righty, what else? Here's one that I bet you hear very, very little about. You actually hear a lot of conversations in informed consent about cost. Providers, especially in a hospital setting, are so far removed from the billing, they wouldn't have any idea. Now, if they're in primary practice, there might be some things that they do actually have a closer connection to, like the fact that this antibiotic is $12 a pill and this one is only 50 cents a pill. They might. But how many informed consent conversations, when they're giving you the antibiotic, they say, I think you need an antibiotic. How many times do they actually say, now there's this antibiotic, and it has this price, and it does this and this, with this and this chance, or there's this antibiotic, but it's this and this, and it does this and this. How many times do you actually have that in informed consent? And yet, a lot of patients would want to know that. A lot of patients would want to know, for example, that there might be one antibiotic you would take 3 days, and one antibiotic you'd want to take 10 days. Even if there was a significant cost difference, some patients would want to know that because the 3-day versus 10-day, or the this cost versus that, or this side effect versus this one, or this one you get nauseous with and this one you don't. These are all things that people, not just cost, but other kinds of things. That gets us into another conversation, which is about side effects. Let's talk about side effects. You're going to say to me, at least the smart opponent to this line of thought is going to say, look, there just are recorded side effects. And so you just tell everybody all the side effects. Why is that statement false? That people just tell?
Well, I mean, what the specific thought that I had in mind has to do with the rarity of some side effects.
There is a huge range of side effects, right? Have you ever gone into one of the pamphlets that comes with a drug and seen the side effects? No one would ever take any drug if you actually just listed all of those side effects. You'd never take anything. Right. Okay. So then what are you going to do? You're not going to just list them. No practitioner ever would. And if you did, nobody would ever take anything. So that's not what you're going to do. So what are you going to do?
List the most common side effects.
You're going to take the most common side effects. The problem, of course, is that the patient in front of you will then not be looking out for the ones that are rare, because you didn't mention the ones that are rare, because if you did, they wouldn't take the drug. It's not easy to figure out what side effects to actually tell people, right? Exactly.
You could also possibly prioritize the most serious side effects and tell what the symptoms and signs look like.
That would be another thing you might do. So you might talk about the most common, or you might talk about the most serious. But those would not be the same conversation, because the most serious and the most common are probably, or at least likely, not to be the same thing. And so when you're actually telling people what information about side effects, you're already making judgments about whether you're going to go with rare, or you're going to go with serious, or you're going to go with frequent, or you're going to go with things that people could quickly detect about themselves. Exactly. All right, what else?
A little bit more like maybe all-encompassing, but just the language that the practitioner chooses to use, there may be a barrier in terms of like what language culture they come from, because I mean the practitioner's gone through like all this like higher education, whereas other person may have a different education.
Oh no, that's perfect. So much of disclosure in terms of what we'll get through will have to do with what kind of language is used to get it through. So there are some words that a lot of people, I would imagine, do know, and not all, but most. Hypertension would be one. People say, oh, okay, I know what that means. That means high blood pressure. We have a synonym for it. And some people won't. But a lot of the words that are used will be words that will not convey the meaning that you might think. I'll give you an example. Mental status. Mental status is one practitioners love. But lay people are like, mental status. Status is about being highfalutin or not. Mental is about your mind. So you could say, well, there might be some compromise to your mental status, and that might actually not get anything through at all in terms of any kind of meaning. And there's tons of words like that. There's also, and the practitioner has the problem of not wanting to appear condescending on the one hand, but also wanting to make sure, not assuming that the lay person doesn't have the information, doesn't have a certain kind of vocabulary. On the other hand, making the assumption in the other way will mean that you could use a word that will have absolutely no meaning for that person. For example, let's imagine you don't know the condition called ectopic pregnancy. You just hear pregnancy. Pregnancy, good. Ectopic pregnancy, not good. So you won't even convey the proper meaning if that person doesn't know the word. So by the very language you're speaking in, you are going to have the problem of how much information gets conveyed. But let's even say that the person that you're talking to understands the technical language of it, could put a definition to it. Why is there still problems in disclosure even once you've gotten the terminology? You're all on the same page about a terminology.
Cultural competence.
Like, give me an example.
Well, what may appear to be a mental illness to a white psychiatrist, if the person is seen, you know, black kids seen by a black psychiatrist because of cultural differences, the black psychiatrist would not come up with the same diagnosis.
Okay, so even the lens, that's even prior to talking about the diagnosis. That's the diagnosis itself. So there's no doubt about it that what one thinks of as abnormal, not in the range of of healthy could differ depending on how much, you know, what your cultural standard is, for example. And that could be true of weight or behavior or any number of things.
Right, even the way a gunshot wound is treated up at Chestnut Hill Hospital as opposed to Temple.
Yes, exactly. No, that's very good too. So when it comes to information, all of those problems are going to rear their head again.
Also numeracy, how people process numbers, numerical information.
Of course. So you not only have the problem of the difference in discrepancy in how risk averse someone is, like, oh, I'll take a 1 in 100 chance. Oh, I'll never take a 1 in 100 chance. You're right, risk aversion. But there might also be the problem of what does it mean to talk about probability. You have a 60% chance of this thing happening. How do you get your head around what the, and that actually is over there under risk processing, under understanding on the other side. So there's part. So we're still on the giving out of information. How do you give out those kind of numbers? And are you comfortable giving it out? For example, you might say to an oncologist, I want to know what my chance of 5-year survival is. And you could have an oncologist who says, every patient is different. I don't feel comfortable giving those kind of statistics. They don't mean anything in the individual case. So you could have somebody, even if the person does know, and even if the person on the other side would be able to wrap their head around what that number is, you could have a difference of opinion about whether that kind of numerical or quantitative spin on what's going on could differ significantly. All right, what else?
Well, even dealing with sexuality, you know, depending on what the person's opinion of gay people or transgender people or whatever, they're treated differently.
Exactly, absolutely. So sexual orientation, folks who are trans, but also even if you're talking about just whether it's in your mind as a practitioner that one's sexuality is important at a certain domain of life. For example, let's imagine that I'm a young clinician and I don't think that people who are 60 have sex anyway, so I don't actually need to tell you that you'd be impotent by taking this drug because you wouldn't be doing that anyway because you're so old that what would you be doing that for? So even at the smaller levels, something that might be absolutely critical to you, I might think, why should I mention that? Aren't you like 82 anyway?
STDs have risen among older people.
So that's what I mean. It's the same thing. If I, for example, don't think you need to know, for example, that you should be using protection because of this, that, or the other side effect or whatever, I don't mention it because I don't think that it's something that when I'm
older
choosing.
Older men getting together with crack girls, you know. And
oh my. Oh my.
In a similar vein, the idea of quality of life issues, that
yes.
If you're talking about risk, that's such a subjective, everyone has their own set of values of what constitutes quality in life. And so for a clinician to anticipate, you know, somebody who's very athletic, the fact that they're not going to have as much energy and that's going to be salient and relevant to that individual, or for somebody else to have blurred vision and they love to read, you know, all these different aspects that
exactly.
are going to be really tough to know, that you'd have exactly. to pull from the individual or have a really good sense of what their values are.
Absolutely. Or you value mental clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't mention that your thinking will be fuzzy or that words won't come as quickly or who knows what. Exactly. Right. Did you want to get in? All right, this is the set, and there's so much more to it, of why the disclosure part is a very problematic thing. And that, I mean, I'm not suggesting that we do without it. I'm suggesting we not be so sanguine about how easy it is and how straightforward. It is not easy, even when everyone on every side is well-intentioned, trying to do the best for their patients, and patients trying to listen very carefully. It's very, very complicated. That's on the disclosure end. All right, what kind of problems do you have on the understanding? The second dimension is understanding. Why is it difficult on the understanding? There'll be some overlap, but not entirely.
Well, I think the more informed you are as a patient about health, the better patient you can be and the better health care you can get.
Okay, so one thing is what is the level of understanding of the disease or the condition or the options or the therapies or the side effects is the patient. So some of what is affecting understanding is how much the person actually knows. And give me an example when somebody knows a lot, how does that affect?
How
is informed consent problematic and complex when you have a patient who actually knows quite a bit?
Well, the physician could think that this is a smart ass, and I, you know.
Yeah.
And especially
sure.
if it's someone who's young, who's just come out of school, and think he's supposed to know more or she's supposed to know more than the patient does, and the patient is giving them information, it creates
okay.
a problem.
All right. Okay. So there's no doubt about that. Well, how else is understanding difficult?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they could interpret stuff differently. You might have the same knowledge base, but could interpret things like risks in different ways, or could interpret, you know, statistics or probabilities in different ways.
Okay, like what?
I guess this has to do more with like the "this can't happen to me" type of thing.
All right.
That type of like interpreting, yes, the risk of bodily harm, death, whatever, yes, is there, but not interpreting that that could actually happen to them.
All right, so and that's dovetailing with the risk processing, but
right.
it's, but yes. So when some of it isn't even that it's not that I'm having a hard time getting my head around it. That could be one problem, but or discrepancy in what you're trying to tell me as the provider and what I'm actually getting. So now we're on the what am I getting side. You could be telling me about risks that you think are actually very realistic, but I have always been an optimistic person. I'm not afraid of risks. And I feel like I understand that happens sometimes in the world, but I don't live my life fearing the things that are very unlikely. And so I hear what you're saying, but I just don't take to heart the kind of concerns that you might have. So especially if we're on a different register here about how risky something is, and we're different in risk averse, I process it through my own level of risk aversion. On the other hand, quite the opposite, you feel like this is a very small risk. And I just don't see it that way. We had a nice case in the last mediation where one of the clinicians talked about how a provider was explaining to a patient that, yes, having this particular type of radiation was like having, I don't know, 1,200 MRIs. But 1,200 MRIs is really not that much, not that lot of MRIs. And some patient would be like, 1,200 MRIs, you want to shoot me full of that? I'm not going to have 1,200 MRIs at one shot to forestall a 10% risk of something else happening. On the other hand, somebody else might say, 10%, that's going to save me a risk of a 10% bad outcome. 1,200 MRIs, so what? But it's the same exact thing. Right? And obviously, the person who's saying it, the clinician who's thinking it's a good idea, is of the latter side. 1,200, who cares? And then the other person listening to it might be like, 1,200. Okay, so no doubt about it. Understanding is affected this way.
So people make different decisions based on like their proximity to like threat. So the same cancer patient right after diagnosis is more likely to choose an aggressive treatment. But that same person, after they've had a chance, you know, after
okay.
they've gone by, or when they're less, as time's gone by from their the point of diagnosis, their how much risk they're going to take on changes.
Okay, so I could be the same person, but over time may have a different way of hearing that information because now I've accumulated different types of experiences or different types of perspective, or I've had different kinds of reflection, even though I'm, the exact same person. I'm now hearing the information, the very same information, differently than I would have heard it before. Okay.
Or you might have more information.
Absolutely. I might hear the same information from the source, but process it differently because now I have different information. Okay. Also, when you give me a piece of information as a provider, you give it in the context of your clinical judgment. How much, for example, you've ever seen such and such happen, or how well, despite what the textbook says, you've seen people fare when they've done such and such. So when you give that piece of information, it's loaded up, and sometimes you can't actually tease apart the fact of the textbook rendition and your judgment based on all that experience that's been infused. That when I get the information, I have no clinical judgment to back it up, to make it perspectival, to understand it in context. So even when you give it to me in a certain way, infused with your judgment, I can't put my judgment on. I don't have parallel judgment to it. So I can't actually register it the way you actually meant it to be heard, because you've contextualized it in a way I can't contextualize it. All right, what else?
Well, some.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
So especially if a patient is just being given a diagnosis and the clinician is trying to explain what it is, they may just be emotionally overwhelmed.
Yes. So I heard the first two sentences. You have this anyway, right? I have a meeting with my boss today. You know, at the end, the other person that's in the meeting, we always like compare notes, because we're like, okay, let me see if I can remember everything that happened. It happened so fast. I you know, what are all the things, you know, trying to figure out what did we take away from this? Did we actually capture everything that happened? Now magnify that problem by the fact that it's not business, it's personal. And so now it's your body, and these are hard things, and they're complex. How much are you actually absorbing, even if everything that you would want to hear was said? How much of what was said did you actually retain? I'll often say to my mother-in-law, so now what did he say, or she, about such and such? I know we talked about that, but I have no idea. You have no idea? Something this critical you left without knowing?
And to your point, the medium through which that information is conveyed, written versus verbal, and if it is written, you know, how clear is it? Are we talking bullet points, that kind of thing?
Right. So even do I retain more when it's written down, or do I retain more when I hear it?
Right.
And actually, like when you get a new boss, you read books, and the books will tell you, figure out if your new boss is somebody who likes things in writing or likes to process things by listening to it. That's true of patients too. The only problem is you have one boss and you have thousands of patients. So when you're trying to figure out how do they process information, you can't actually tell. And very few people will walk up to you and say, I like it in writing, or whatever, right? The other thing is we're all pinched for time, and so this has to be done in a certain amount of time. And even how much you're gonna be able to get from someone has a lot to do with how much time they think a particular discussion of something ought to take. So for example, let's imagine that you are having anesthesia for some diagnostic test, colonoscopy, let's use, because everybody's supposed to have those when they hit a nasty age that I don't want to, whatever. But let's say you're in an anesthesia conversation, because they're going to give you some conscious sedation. Now this is not your anesthesiologist's big discussion, right? This is you give a little conscious sedation, the person's under for, I don't know how long colonoscopy takes, I would think 30 minutes, an hour, I don't know, right? Am I ballpark it?
Is that right? I don't remember.
Yeah, I know, well, you're not gonna remember it. It's gotta be the GI guy who tells us, but like I would, or a woman. So I would imagine, I don't know, let's say it's an hour. This is not a big anesthesiology deal compared to someone who's got a very complex situation, is gonna go into general anesthesia, the operation's gonna take 8 hours. That's where the anesthesiologist wants to bring out her expertise, not on the little tap and put, give you a little conscious sedation. So they're expecting to go in, they're gonna say, you're gonna have your propofol, it's gonna wear off, sign here. But no, this person's all about how I can't get wake up from anesthesia, you know, I never get it titrated, right? So even those kind of conversations, which is, look, this is supposed to be a 2-minute conversation, not the half hour consult, can affect what kind of information is given and certainly what kind of information is received. So are you matched up well in the informed consent process, even going between how much disclosure one person thinks is appropriate versus how much understanding the other person thinks she deserves, right? I mean, there's a certain amount, you can imagine a clinician saying, look, you want to go to med school, help yourself. Right now, we got job to do, and it can't be that I mind meld myself so that you know everything I know. Nobody ever talks like that. But that's kind of the idea. When you've got somebody who's disclosing this much and on a receiving end of somebody who wants this much understanding, and that problem gets flipped. Because you know it's the case that some people on the patient side want this much or this much, and the provider wants to give this much. The provider has all kinds of reasons for wanting to give this much. Some, cover your ass. Some, it's my obligation. Some, I can't in good conscience let you do this if you don't understand. Like, there's a whole array of why I feel like you need this much information, and you're basically saying, give me the sheet and let me sign. I don't want to hear anything. Just do what you think needs to be done.
Well, you don't have any choice sometimes. I know it's stupid, but sometimes I just sign stuff because I know I'm not going to get what you have to offer unless I sign.
Yeah, well, or what they have to offer is the only thing you want.
Right.
You could have a dead baby, or you could have a C-section. Give me the form, I'll sign.
Don't get it.
Right? Yeah. I mean, if the only thing you want is the thing, that there's only one way to get the thing you want, live baby, you're going to sign. So do you have to hear everything? The clinician will say yes, because then you can look out for this complication, or you'll know that I told you this, or whatever. And the patient might say, you know what, that's what waiving your right is. I don't want to hear it. Just this is what we're going to do, and now I'm going to sign. That's the interplay between disclosure and understanding, even if it weren't complicated enough. All right, point made. Now, voluntariness, you know that there are ways in which, despite a clinician's absolute good intentions to not manipulate, that's not what they're trying to do, you know that sometimes patients can get manipulated by information. How? What would be a way in which you could have information given to you in a way that is manipulative, but you're not talking about some evil, you know, Mengele type of doctor?
The framing of it.
Okay.
Saying, like, you know, I think this is your best option, or this is what I would do, or
okay.
Stuff along those lines.
And often that comes from the very well-intentioned concern that you're making the wrong choice. How could it be the case that you could actually be protecting your own interests but be making a choice very different from the one the provider, in her wisdom and experience, thinks is a foolish one? How could you actually be protecting your life and well-being, but choosing something that a provider thinks is a foolhardy option? Can you that will get us in a minute into the Veach, but can you give me an example of that? Where I actually care about you, and I don't want you to do the thing that you're saying you're going to do, because I think you're actually making a wrong choice for you. But it turns out, actually, you're making the right choice for you, and I just can't see it. Can you give me an example?
Home birth.
Exactly. Good example. Okay, spell home birth.
Home birth.
Give me an example of that one.
Home birth.
And tell me how that gets fleshed out.
Well, there are lots of risks to medical interventions. There's some understanding that as soon as you walk into a hospital, you're already at increased risk for intervention, side effects, and all the sort of like the slippery slope to the C-section. So lots of people choose home birth because they have this idea of like sort of this cushy idea of, you know, kind of hippie birth, but because they're not interested in taking the risks that come along with just entering a hospital.
Right. Right. That would be a perfect example of where your risk assessment of, yes, things go wrong in a certain percentage of cases. Of the things that go wrong in a certain percentage of cases, there are warnings for this majority of those things that could go wrong, such that I could actually be transferred. So when I add all that up, I find myself saying, I've got an overwhelmingly good odds of nothing bad happening. Of the bad things that can happen, I have a very, very small odd of something happening without me being able to have it addressed by being transferred. But the other person might be looking at you saying, how would you ever take a risk like that with your baby? Even the tiniest risk. And that happens all the time. Not just with home birth, but in the realm of OB-GYN, it happens a lot. For example, it used to be the case that you could have a VBAC after cesarean. Then a study came out that said you have a 1% risk of a uterine rupture if you have a VBAC after cesarean. 1% risk. Some hospitals made it absolutely policy that no woman could even select the option of trying a VBAC after cesarean, because they said, but a vaginal birth after a cesarean, to try it naturally the second time after one had a C-section, because the study came out and said, we cannot support a 1% risk of a uterine rupture. Not even a 1% risk, we cannot support it. You cannot even try it. But you can imagine that there are women in hospitals and doctors too on the other side saying 99% chance this is not going to happen is not a good reason for a policy that nobody could have it. On the other hand, you can imagine where someone would be saying, I have to make sure that not even a 1% chance, given how dire the circumstance would be, we have to make it a policy that we will not allow anyone under our care to take this kind of risk. Those are pretty disparate value perspectives, but they would look at each other as thinking they were making a foolish choice, or at least a choice that wouldn't be good for them respectively. Alrighty, so that's okay, and how you would portray that was already illustrated. You want to take a 1% chance risk with a baby you desperately want? knowing that you want to have children after this, you would take a chance not only on something happening to the baby, but having perhaps a hysterectomy from this rupture, or maybe even losing your life, you would want to take that chance, would be one framing. Here would be another framing. You know, I got to tell you, you had the upside down baby. That's why you had the C-section. Your chance of not having the head down baby the second time aren't good. You're probably going to have a head down baby. Give it a shot. It's only a 1% chance that you're going to have something dire. That's a 99% chance. In your case, I think it's going to go very well. I would totally support you. Those are very different frames. And if you were on the one side or the other, you could find yourself manipulated in terms of your voluntariness, depending on that frame. So voluntariness, it can look like, well, I can only be coerced if I'm actually coerced. I will not let you do this. Actually, you can be coerced, or at least manipulated, but far short of anything like coercion. Okay, and then that brings us to confidence. Because, of course, part of informed consent is the ability to make the decision once you've actually gotten the information and you've understood it. But there are, of course, those that we have decided, deemed either very obviously or not so obviously, not competent to make their own decision. And in those cases, we argue that there has to be surrogate decision making. Now, the reason I'm hedging on this is because there are some cases when it's probably going to be without dispute that a surrogate needs to make a decision. Obviously, cases like you're unconscious. You're unconscious, so you're pretty much not going to speak for yourself. Or you aren't even ever going to wake up because you're in a persistent vegetative state, so you're going to have to speak for you. Somebody's going to have to speak for you. So there are clear times when I think we're all in agreement that the person who cannot wake up will not make her own decisions. Those are some slam dunks. On the other hand, competency is a real, it is sticky terrain, because we can deem someone not competent to make a decision based on reasons that are far short of somebody not being conscious. Like, you just disagree with me. You disagree with me and I can't get my head around you actually being sane and disagreeing with me, so you must be incompetent. Or you are making a decision that is so spectacularly risky for your body that I can't think that you actually are making an informed decision. Or you have some type of other mental illness that is clouding your judgment, like depression or schizophrenia or bipolar disease, that is making you not able to make choices. These are much more gray areas. Some will not even think they are gray. Some will just think they're pure competence. But they might start the conversation about surrogate decision making. In fact, that's what happens a lot of times when somebody has a competency assessment in a hospital situation or an informed consent decision process. Let's imagine we've all gotten on board with, we're using a fairly straightforward case where somebody isn't in the gray zone, they just are flat out unconscious, and so someone has to make a decision for them. So what I did with that first part was try to show you how competence itself can be very problematic, can be very gray. But even if it's very cut and dry in a particular case, there are three standards that the surrogates, even if we agree the surrogate needs to come in and make a decision, there are three standards a surrogate could be held to. So I want to look at each of these three standards, and I want to look at how each one of these is also problematic. Let's talk first about substituted judgment. What is substituted judgment as a standard for giving informed consent, for making surrogate decisions?
Making the decision in the best interest of that person?
Not in the best interest. That's number three.
As the patient would have judged.
Right. This is what you think the patient wants. The other one is pure autonomy. We'll get them all up here so you can look at them carefully and consider them all. In substituted judgment, you are trying to decide, based on what you know of the person, what that person would want. Okay. What are your odds? We've talked about this, I know, this semester. What are your odds of getting this right by studies that have been designed to say, here are the loved ones, here are the pretend patients, let's ask the patients what they want in this circumstance, let's ask the loved ones what they think they would want. What are your odds of actually getting it right?
Very slim. 50-50. 50-50.
It's a flip of the coin. Flip of the coin. All right, so substituted judgment is not particularly good. That leaves us in a real quagmire because pure autonomy, which is the patient's stated wishes, it's also problematic, even if you had it, which you often don't. So substituted judgment is a very difficult standard for substituted judgment because your odds of being right aren't too good, especially if you haven't had it backed up with the pure autonomy standard, which is where the patient expresses his or her wishes about what he or she would want. And that, of course, is always comforting to people who are in the throes of surrogate decision making to know, what is it that Sue or Tom, my daughter, my mother, would have wanted if she or he were making that decision? That feels very comforting, and we have institutions that are built around helping to give that information to surrogate decision maker, like what?
Advanced directive.
Advanced directive, exactly.
Living will.
Which is a living will.
Same thing.
And then we got the healthcare proxy. The healthcare proxy is actually where I hand over to you the rights to make decisions for me, and you make them as if I'm speaking. Doesn't mean you get it right. It's that I trust so much in decision-making reflection that I don't care if it's what I actually would want. I just know that as the situation changes, you'll make the best decision because I trust you to do the right thing for me. So it's not that I'm saying you know me best, maybe you do, but it's that I'm handing over to you the way of speaking for me, and you will speak for me, and I trust that you will get it right. And maybe you do have some advanced directive information as your base. Maybe it's just long knowing someone. But either way, I don't care. I give over my healthcare decisions to someone that I think will look at the situation from the kind of values or concerns that I would have and make the decision that I trust. Okay. But let's imagine that you actually... We think that if we have an advanced directive, let's leave healthcare proxy because in a way it's not even substituted judgment anymore. It's like I'm standing there. I actually have all authority to speak for this other person. So it's like I am the patient. So it's not really in a way anymore in the substituted decision realm. It is, but it's not quite the same thing as when you don't have healthcare proxy and you really are trying to make a decision for someone else not speaking in their own voice. Now we think that if we have something like an advanced directive, we've got all the guidance we need. Why does the pure autonomy standard fail us even when we have an advanced directive? How could it potentially fail us?
Usually there are like lots of other, you know, factors going into the position they're in rather than what they just wrote in that advanced directive.
Exactly. If the values and priorities are difficult when I'm actually sitting here trying to figure out what I want, imagine what it's like when I'm not sitting here, I'm lying there, I'm unconscious, you've got some piece of paper that's trying to lay out what I actually care about, but not being filtered through my filter, being filtered through your filter, for example. Okay? What else about those advanced directives? Why should we be suspicious that we have a pure autonomy standard, that we're achieving the words from the source herself when we have an advanced directive? Why should we? I'm not saying we should disregard an advanced directive. I'm saying that we shouldn't pat ourselves on the back and feel like, well, we've got all the answers. It's right there, just like the Torah. We just have to study it enough, and our advanced directive will tell us exactly what to do. Why do they not work that way? Why else? What kind of things do they say? Give me an example of something an advanced director would say.
DNR.
Okay, it'll say, do not resuscitate. It won't just say, put in a DNR, because then you'd actually have a DNR in place. So it's actually going to say,
do not resuscitate.
If,
you know, I'm on, I don't know.
It won't. It'll say, if, do not resuscitate if. Won't say if I'm on a presser. It's not going to say that. It's going to something like that, right? It's going to say, do not resuscitate. Put a DNR in place if. If what?
Like to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, the situation is hopeless.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just in that line alone, just to a reasonable degree, medical certainty, and I'm not going to recover, just think about it. What exactly is recover? Does it mean survive? Does it mean survive for a week? Does it mean survive for three months? Does it mean survive in a nursing home? Does it mean survive unconscious? Does it mean survive with supportive care like air and food? What is recover? What is a reasonable chance? Is your reasonable chance of recovery 1 in 100, 10 in 100, 50 in 100, 16 in 100? What does medical certainty mean? Does anybody ever say any? I mean, it's interesting. You pin down a clinician like sometimes in, like in a mock. No, I wouldn't do this in a real mediation, but in a mock mediation, you might pin a clinician down and you'll say, "Well, is it absolutely hopeless?" Well, there's always hope. I mean, there's all there. So when are you going to get this? If there's no certainty, kind of criterion, are you not going? The advance directive is as muddy. I'm not saying it's like you have nothing, and I'm not suggesting you don't get one. I'm saying it's not like it speaks clearly because it's in the eyes of the beholder standing around. Have we met that criterion? And you can have people read the exact same line and say, oh yeah, we've met the criterion. No, we haven't met the criterion. And one of my favorite examples of this, I think I've given in this class, where a MICU attending had a patient brought in from another hospital, and the person had an advance directive that said that if I've been on a ventilator for a certain course of time, you know, a certain trial run, a couple of weeks, I would like my ventilator withdrawn because that evidence to me, that's evidence that I will not get better. And the clinician said, oh, but I just think they've got the diagnosis wrong. I think they think that this person has condition A, but actually I think it's condition B. I think this is a temporary problem. I think in this case it was this thing called post-polio syndrome. And I think what we need to do is just a this and a that, and then we actually will be able to wean this person will go back to his or her life. But the advance directive spoke like the tablets, thou shalt not kill. I mean, it was just as clear as day in this particular thing. If I've been on the ventilator for this amount of time and I've shown no improvement, then care should be withdrawn. But the attending simply said, yes, but what's really meant by that is the indication is that if you've been on for a long time and you aren't getting better, that things are just going to continue like that and you're never going to get better. But if you've been on for a certain amount of time, but there actually is a really good chance that you are going to fully get better, then that isn't what the advance directive meant, though it said it like, as I said, honor thy father and mother. I mean, it just laid it right there. So it was just ignored. They just ignored the advance directive. They just said, I'm sorry, this is not what this person would have meant. It couldn't be. Person, you know the end of the story, right? It's got to be. It wouldn't be fun if they, ignoring the advance directive, they weren't able to get this thing under control and wean the guy, and he went back to work, and he's still living now. So, again, the fact that you've got the pure autonomy standards speaking to you out loud still leaves room for judgment. But most of the things don't actually have, they're not actually built in there. Like, would this person like to start dialysis? Or would this person want another course of chemotherapy? Or would this person want a withdrawal of feeding? Who knows? I mean, most of the time, they're not even built in. So even if you have the stated wishes, it's hard to understand what the stated wishes are. But it's more than that. Because when you state the wishes you have, you state them from not actually being in the situation that you're in when the wishes would actually take hold. And so some people will say, looking at advance directive, that was an easy thing to say in situation A, but circumstance B is a different circumstance. So let me give you an example, because how could that be? Let's imagine that Autumn says in every class she teaches, pull the plug. If I can't go back to teaching philosophy, pull the plug. That's absolutely what I think. Unless I think about the fact that if you keep me plugged in, I'll be able to collect, my family will be able to collect long-term disability on me for quite a long time from Penn, which is a significant amount of money, as a matter of fact, to keep my family going. So as a matter of fact, even though right now I'm telling you that I would like you to pull the plug, it could turn out to be the case that my deeply held wishes would be that you don't pull the plug, that you just keep me alive so those checks keep coming from Penn so my kids can eat. So while I'm not thinking about my kids or before I have kids, I'm saying, absolutely, I would never want to live like that, so just get, you know, just withdraw care on me. But there could be a circumstance so different from the one that I foresaw when I was in that situation that my surrogate might say, you know what, I know her, and I know that she wouldn't care that she's robbing Penn blind for work she's never going to continue to do, and she's just going to want every check she can get to help her family. I know this of her. But, well, that's not what the advance directive said. My circumstance can be so different when I actually state my wishes from what my wishes are when the wishes actually come into play that they may actually not be reflective of what I would truly want. I'm not sure how anybody would detect this, but that's a different question. My concern here is that we think these things speak clearly and definitively and transparently, and they actually don't. And that means that the autonomy standard is a very different, difficult standard to achieve too. And then that only leaves the best interest standard. So what's going to be problematic about that? This is where the surrogate is trying to think about the highest net benefit given all of the competing concerns. So I'm trying to think, well, what would be the best interest, all things considered, in this particular case? Why is that not so easy either?
Just the best interest of the person, or like
everyone? That's part of the problem. You're exactly right. Whose best interest? What aspect? Can you give me an example where you'd have two competing interests? I'm trying to think about what to do for you. But can you give me an example where there'd be two interests that you might legitimately have as you, not as some random, you know, generic person, but you yourself, you might have two interests, but they actually compete. They actually advocate for antithetical options, opposing choices.
Same as you, like if I wouldn't want to live like that, but if I keep getting money, like my family gets financial support from it, like,
right. So on the one hand, if my own interest, if the only thing I think about is me and what is good for me, that might be very different from the fact that I actually sometimes even care more about someone else than I care about me. So if you just looked at what's in the patient's best interest, oh, it's not fair to do that to her, you might miss the fact that in my interest, if I were assessing it, I would want you to put my interest second to somebody else's interest. So that's where, even if you did understand what my best interest would be, you might not understand that I wouldn't want you to be, I'd be thinking it would be selfish of me to prioritize myself with how little suffering I'm going to have in the unconscious state for how much good I might be able to do if you didn't treat me as if I were if I needed to act so selfishly. So I actually might not even want you to act in my best interest. But sometimes, you, even if you were just focusing on me and my best interest, you might get wrong what is in my best interest. Give me two examples, you know, competing things where I might think, well, clearly this would be in your best interest. But you might think it's actually not in my best interest.
I mean, just if you're on life support, length of life versus quality of life, in the state of Pennsylvania, I think the default is that if there's no advance directive, if there's no healthcare proxy, you're going to be, you know, the priority is in your best interest to be kept alive. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, your own interest might be to have a quality of life, that have mental capacity and not be a vegetable.
Right, you know? Exactly. So while I'm actually trying to do what's in your best interest, I decide that either living on is your best interest or not living on is your best interest. But I might actually choose, even when I'm thinking, trying to get your best interest, it might be the best interest for most people, but just not the best interest for you. So best interest standard is also very difficult. When you get all that together, you can understand why Veach wrote the piece he did that said that informed consent is actually very, very difficult. And not at all, you know, Veach and Childress had already illustrated this with their piece, but Veach ramps it up to another level because he says this process that we take as the cornerstone of patient autonomy actually, ironically, is quite authoritarian. How could you see informed consent as being quite authoritarian? What would make it? That didn't work. What do you think is the reason here? Okay, if I just go, hopefully I won't get injured. All right. Why would you say it's authoritarian? Because in a lot of ways, it's been very clear tonight that folks that informed consent is engaged in the spirit of empowerment and very much well intentioned. So how could it turn out to be the case that it ends up being authoritarian?
The person administering the informed consent decides what information that person needs. And gives it.
Basically, the whole dialogue, despite the good intentions of the person giving the information, that is the person with all of the control. In other words, So I can certainly ask as the patient what I want to know. But I have to know enough to know what to ask. So again, unless I am someone who's done a lot of independent research, and even then there's complications, but what questions I know to ask are usually dependent on what I've already been told. If you think about the word authoritarian, not as a synonym for bossy, or a synonym for, or in the cluster of totalitarian, or certainly ill, malevolently meant. If you don't think of it like that at all, but you think instead of it like this: who's in the driver's seat? Then, regardless of the intention of the person who's given the information, they're in the driver's seat. And if they're in the driver's seat, there's already a hierarchy about who's driving, leading, pushing the conversation, who's sculpting it, molding it, by and large, and who's actually on the passive end of it. Who's got to be either the victim or the recipient or the person who's the receptacle for it.
Yeah, and in a lot of the cases, the patient might not actually even have a choice. Like, that would be the only alternative, maybe.
Yeah, And Veach's point as a clinician is not to say, well, look, let's just be honest and I'll just tell you what to do. He doesn't, of course, we know that that's not where his outcome is going to be. But he does want us to be a little bit less hasty about how we hold up informed consent as a panacea, or as even the paragon of patient autonomy. He wants us to call a spade, look at it squarely in the eye, and see we don't really have the kind of full-out autonomy that we wish we had, or that we deceive ourselves in thinking that we have. Okay, so let's look at the details of it. And let's talk first. This will just be, in some ways, corralling a lot of what we've already talked about. But let's deepen it a little bit and put it a little bit more theoretically in the spirit of Veach's piece. Let's think about the way in which every person has a collection, and I can put this definition up here, of values, priorities, beliefs, commitments, moral principles, temperament and personality, traits, dispositions, and proclivities. If you think about this whole set, and each one of us has it, and each one of us has a unique set, then we can think about how the problem of informed consent from both directions can be theorized in this concept of the conception of the good. That if we understood Autumn's conception of the good up against Joyce's conception of the good, up against Tom's conception of the good, then whichever role we're in, patient or provider, we could start to see how information and the processing of it and the approach to it and the receptivity to it is going to be very much filtered through the lens that's created by this constellation of what the individual cares about. So I want you to think about, give me some concrete examples of elements in your conception of the good, or someone you know, so you don't have to self-identify, but that could be in a conception of the good that would very much play out in a conversation about informed consent, in a therapeutic conversation about what to do, about treatment and diagnosis and prognosis and all the rest of it. Give me an example of what could be in a conception of the good. Give me a set, like a belief, and I'll give some concrete lists over here. Do you need me to start us off? Do you have one?
If you've had the malady and you have, your patient is there and you say, I had it, so, you know, I know what's best.
All right. So in some ways, there could be a weight given one's past or personal experience. So you could be someone who says, the fact that I've already experienced this it bears repeating, bears conveying. That's a value that I care about, that what we are, one of the things that can be helpful, patient or provider, you know, whichever one side I'm on, is to share our and connect from experiences we've had. And so if I had a provider say something like this recently, and I'm trying to think about what was it? And I remember thinking, because I'm not somebody who likes personal sharing in some of these ways, that was one piece of information too many. And I'm going to try to think about it, because what struck me about how I wasn't sure that I felt comfortable with the provider coming down into the patient role, what struck me about my reaction was that it was not particularly personal in terms of what it was. In other words, it wasn't of the arena that we typically think about as the personal and intimate, you know, the genital, gynecological, sexual. It was not in that arena at all. And yet I was like, and I don't know what it was. Was it, it was something like, something as simple as like somebody getting a stomach irritation from ibuprofen. Like it was that kind of level. It was not personal in that way, right? That's not what it was, but when I can think of it, I'll tell you, because it was not personal. And yet the idea that that in this person's conception of the medical good, of how one ought to be, the idea that your past experience or personal experience should weigh in, conflicted, again, these are not right or wrong, these are just your value set, conflicted with whether I thought that was a good change in role to have. So I would not, and I'm, again, I'm a little fuzzy on it, but it reminded me, so, and I'll just say it in this generic way. One person might think that the sharing of personal information from the provider to the patient is comforting, illuminating, helpful, insightful. But the person on the other side might have a conception of the good that says, I am unique, I don't want to be here to hear about your problems. What's happening with me is not analogous to what's happening with you, right? You could have somebody on the complete other end of that one. All right, what else? I'll give you one. One person might have a view that positive thinking is material to healing. And another person might think, yeah, let's get out the crystals. Mm-hmm. And so it can sound like hocus pocus to one person, but it can be very, very important and the cornerstone of healing for another. Right?
For a physician might think that I should tell my patients everything.
All right, so I might have a bias in favor of more is more. And somebody else might have a perspective that less is more. The less I know, the less frightened I am, and the better that you know, it's the bliss of ignorance that will help and that will protect me. And the other person might say, knowledge is power. That would be a completely diametrically opposed conflict. Again, not judgment here on right and wrong, merely complexifying what it's like to be talking about information and what we do, how we get this idea of this that we, you know, that we think that informed consent doesn't have layers to it, and driving towards this idea that it's authoritarian. I mean, if I drive a conversation as a provider that says, now I need you to muster up all your resources for positive thinking, I am driving you towards a certain view that you simply don't have. It is authoritarian in that sense, though it's so well meant on my side. So again, we have to understand this whole conversation is not about judgment in that sense, and yet it shows a certain type of who's got the reins.
Different priorities,
like what?
Quality of life versus quantity.
All right, let's just stay even in the quality of life versus the quantity. There's no doubt about it. Even inside quality of life, we can have very different views about what quality of life is. And then we can have it exacerbated by the fact that some people would rather have less of it, but of a certain type. Okay, can you give me an example?
Of less of it, but a
certain type. Any of it, either one. Either one of your example, or,
you know, different values of what it means.
Give me in concrete, like say it without using word values. Like, give me an example. So and so might have the value of this.
That they don't want their family to see them
you know, having inconsistency or like.
All right. So one of the things that you might value is being able to have your mind or body with in a certain type of intactness, because being viewed or interacted with in a compromised either mental or physical state is to you so abhorrent, and someone else might not mind the and might see even value in being being on the receiving end of care and knowing that somebody loves you no matter how much compromise there is to your body or your mind. So one person, for example, might, did I give this example of my of one of my professors in that I had in college? I saw him, very elderly. He had moved to Princeton after he retired. So we actually lived in the same town. And I remember seeing him in a wheelchair in the Princeton hospital. And I remember thinking, is he someone who would not want former students to see him like this? Or is he someone who would welcome a connection from the past and would find it validating? And that very much plays into the conception of the good. He might have found it so humiliating to be seen in that decrepit state. On the other hand, he might have found it so validating that someone would remember him after all of those years. I didn't know, so I didn't know what to do. But the point is, they illustrate nicely the part of the conception of the good in terms of healthcare. All right, what else?
So what did you do?
I felt that my instinct said he wouldn't want it. He was very proud, in the best sense of proud, but that he always comported himself with certain type of dress and mannerism. He was very polished. I didn't think he would want me to see him like that. So I walked on. I pretended I didn't see him. Not because I wanted to ignore him, but because I didn't know which conception of the good he was operating under. And I knew that, but you know, I knew that it was a risk either way. What else on the conception of the good?
So different beliefs in a higher power?
Yes.
Absolutely. May believe, you know, that this is in the hands of God. Some people may believe that having a certain type of procedure or a surgery would mean that in a next life I will be compromised.
Yes, and there's all kinds of things that are built around religion. Getting blood products, not getting blood products. Experiencing pain. Pain is redemptive, or pain as superfluous, useless. Humankind, being given the capability to end pain, as opposed to pain as part of the human condition and teaching lessons. All kinds of things that surround conceptions of the good that are interfused with religious beliefs that you can absolutely hit it wrong. A classic clinical ethics case will be a family patient and loved ones who believe that pain is redemptive, while providers with Western capabilities of addressing pain aren't allowed to give pain relief. And so the conundrum, especially if the person is in so much pain that they're not speaking coherently for themselves, whether, you know, with those values at stake, you can absolutely imagine that a loved one has it completely right that patient would not want pain relief. You could also imagine that person, if she or he were experiencing that pain, would want the pain relief, and it's very easy, perhaps, sometimes to say, yeah, don't give it to him or her. Her soul will be protected. But we don't really know whether that's actually an authentic belief. So, again, in this informed consent. But those are very good examples. All right, what else? There are some people who might have the view that getting the highest chance of success, recovery, cure is worth any price. I will take any chance at all, as long as it's, you know, as long as it's true, as long as it's a fact. Not like, okay, well, let's get some Laetril or whatever. But if it's actually, there is documentation that you could have a 1%, 5%, 10%, no matter what the cost, no matter what the suffering, somebody might say, I'll take the highest chance. On the other hand, somebody might have the perspective, and I'll give you a case. I have the stick. I'm here to help me get it right. But I might be of the mindset that I'll rather take a lower chance, even though I want to live. I'm not talking quality of life versus quantity in that sense. But I will take a lower chance of success for some other type of gain that I care about. And so here's my example. Someone with an aggressive but stage 1 cancer who's got a 30% lifetime risk of having cancer in the second breast, deciding that a 30% chance but retaining the breast is worth it, and someone else saying, I want a bilateral mastectomy because I don't want the 30% chance, even though the disfigurement is a serious issue for me. If you have a case like that, having the patient and the surgeon on different sides of that issue will be a significant clash in the conception of the good. So a surgeon who says, for cosmetic reasons, you would take a 30% chance of an aggressive cancer, and the other person says, I have a 70% chance that I will not need a disfigurement at all. So that would be the bias on the minimize your chance of recurrence or adverse effect events, maximize your chance of cure, no matter what the personal, aesthetic, cosmetic, emotional, or even moral. How could moral get in there? Can you give me a case where you might make a medical, your conception of the good might have you make a medical decision that is based on a moral concern? Let's not use abortion or you know, contraception. Think more creatively there. But that you might make a medical choice based on a moral concern, where if you were just making it on a healthcare concern, you wouldn't make it. You think of one?
Like a blood transfusion with a Jehovah's Witness?
Yeah, it's sort of classic. Let's think about how it, you know, because there are stock ones, right? There's abortion, there's blood products.
Mm-hmm. Organ transplant with regard to, you know, you're next in queue, but for moral reasons,
yes,
you feel like somebody else might be more deserving.
All right, so you might say, I am so sick and the odds that this will help me are so small that I'm going to forgo this because even though I want to live, there's somebody who has a much better chance of actually making use of this. It'd be quite an extraordinary sacrifice, but it could.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I actually had the exact same.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Here's the kind of thing that I was thinking, but there's lots of these kind of examples. I might forego a certain type of treatment because even though the treatment that's being proposed, treatment A, might give me better outcome for me personally, it might actually cause me, for example, to be more of a burden to my family. I might have more of a convalescence, for example, or I might have to be out of work longer so I won't be able to provide financially for my family, or I won't be able to attend to my children's needs because the effect on me in the short run will be too significant. So I will take whatever. The knee replacement might be the thing that's best for me, but being laid up, like I might be laid up, might be such an imposition from my perspective or such an assault to my family that I will take the pain and the disability and forego the short-term convalescence, even though it would be a better outcome in the long run, because I've got other obligations that speak against the better option if I were thinking just for my health care. And others might say, you know, your quality of life is so bad right now, how could you not want this surgery? When it clearly is so critical to your personal health and well-being in terms of your health. All right, so that's where the conception of the good helps us understand where our various commitments shade, cloud, alter, modify what kind of information we have and choices that we would ultimately make. Let's talk about the conflict of interest that might occur. How could there be conflicts of interest between the patient and the provider, and even between inside the provider or inside the patient? What kind of needs and interests can conflict?
Well, the provider does have there's a greater chance of malpractice.
Okay, that's a good one.
And you choose the one that exposes her to the greater chance of malpractice.
Yes. So, for example, I might think that a VBAC is actually not a bad medical choice, but the reason that it's such a bad choice is because if the bad outcome of uterine rupture happens, my burden of malpractice is actually going to be very serious. So I am urging you not to do it, not because I think it's not a good option for your health, but because I'm not sure it's a good option for my professional practice.
This has just been sued.
Yeah, right, which, you may have actually known this concern intimately. Right, exactly. All right, what other conflicts?
I don't know if this is on target, but the doctors need to be the healer, to be...
Good one. Okay, so I don't want you to give up, not because I can't understand why you would call off some kind of treatment, but because it disempowers me or makes me feel helpless and sad that I can't do what I need to do, or that I can't fulfill my commitment as a healer, that I'm being thwarted in what my psychological, emotional, professional obligations or needs are. And so I am urging you to keep going because I can't stomach or face that I'm not going to be able to do for you what I want to do for you. That's good. What else?
In a similar vein to the Jehovah's Witness one, where if you have gangrene and there's the option to amputate, let's say, but you want to make it into heaven with the entirely embodied, and the doctor has the priority of saving your life. And that's mm-hmm. not differences of.
Oh, that's of a good priority. One. Uh-huh. Good. Mm-hmm. Or. The doctor thinks that a lumpectomy isn't as good an option for you as a mastectomy, but the cosmetic implications for you are so serious that you want to take a greater chance and go with lumpectomy. So there's a conflict between a need on the one hand that somebody might not validate or value of the aesthetic body for the physically healthy body. All right, good. So that's on the idea of conflict and of interest. So all of this leads Veach to think that we need to have communities where deep values between providers and patients could be shared. Now, of course, out of the starting gate, we're immediately going to dismiss that, but let's not dismiss it out of the starting gate. Let's talk about if we were going to really give it the old college try to achieve it. What would be some of the deep values that you would want people to share? And don't give it to me like this. Don't say, well, we should have the same religion. I want you to actually scratch the surface of that, because I want you to not take on face value that by the fact that you name yourself as an adherent to this or that creed, that you actually have enough of the shared values that matter. So you can show me how you might, and that would be fine. Like, you could say, well, I am a such and such. I want a doctor who's a such and such, because we would both, and then don't give me Jehovah's Witness, I'll just give you that one. So yes, if I'm Jehovah's Witness and the minister is Jehovah's Witness, the physician is Jehovah's Witness, then when I don't want blood products, everybody's going to be on the same page, nobody's going to condemn me, and they're going to get, okay, fine. But now let's scratch the surface a little bit more. So you can give me religion, but show me how it's gonna make you feel like you really are understood, that the kind of problems and the kind of disjuncts you have had, either with a patient or with a provider, either as a patient or a provider, would be remedied, rectified, if you were of the same value system.
One general value would be that medical decision-making is a collaborative process.
Okay, that would be that's an excellent example. If I am somebody who wants, let's imagine you're the provider and that's your view, it's a collaborative process. And I'm a patient who believes, I don't pay you to teamwork. I pay you to give an opinion that is based on long clinical judgment. So if I want to have a teamwork, I can just go to work. Or whatever. But if I want to come to an expert and get a consultation, I'm paying you for your expertise. That would be a value disjunct. So if you had two people who really believe, look, we're in partnership, and they meant it all the way down, two people who are on that same page might really gel. And then, what would be the, give me an example of what would be easy in that relationship that would not be easy if you didn't have somebody who thought of you as a collaborator. Give me an example of what wouldn't be easy. So I'm a patient and I want a collaborative relationship. You're a doctor, you want a collaborative relationship. That's all good. What am I going to have in that relationship that I wouldn't have if you were not a collaborator? What would be one thing that would be easy for us in our informed consent?
Authority.
Like, okay, so yes, it certainly wouldn't be good if you were, if the other person were very authoritarian, but give me a concrete. You're right, but give me something that's very concrete.
In the collaborative example.
That you are glad you have,
right.
That you wouldn't have if one of you weren't.
Right. I mean, you have access to the patient's values and you can actually put things on the table and you can kind of problem solve in a dynamic way. Instead of saying in the authoritative way, this is what's going on, you're not really pulling for accessing patients' thoughts and values as they relate to different options.
All right, so you might have introduced the idea of what's most important to you here, kind of conversation. All right?
Right.
You can just asking for permission. So rather than saying here's what's going to happen next, just saying, you know, explaining and saying, is it all right if, you know, we do this?
Okay. All right.
Just that.
All right. So someone who. Who understands that interventions in someone else's body, believes that interventions in someone else's body always require a kind of request because they can't just be assumed. Might be a good matchup, you're saying, for, okay? What else? So here's one I often think about. A deeply held a belief that there is a kind of uncertainty in medical information, or that that facts can have very different interpretations, rather than there's a this way and the wrong way, might be one. What else? Give me some others. How about somebody who likes to think out of the box? This is the way we typically do things, but you know what? This is an unusual situation. Let's see if we can get some creative solutions here. How do we think in a different way? How can we solve this problem in a way that's not our typical? So somebody who might, for example, bend on a policy because would say, yeah, that's typically a protective policy, but in this case, we need to think out of the box a little bit and see how could we work with you? How could we make something happen? What else?
Well, the bigger the better, the more something costs, the better the treatment is.
All right, so if for example, you had two people who were both on the same page of cost is not an issue, we're not going to worry about cost here, we're just going to do everything that we need to do, versus the conception of the good that says, you know what, good enough is good enough, not absolute best, boutique. So I'll take the less than absolutely perfect option if it's cost effective, for example. All right, what else? Somebody who's equally a risk averse or risk embracing, or at least is very appreciative of the difference that people have in risk. Now, think about that whole assembly that we've just had here. None of those would actually be easy to say, well, I'd like to be part of the so-and-so HMO because the so-and-so HMO or the so-and-so practice or this particular internal medicine or that specialty group has these values. These are not the kind of values, so part of it, highlighting why Veach's suggestion, while compelling, it seems a little bit hard to obtain, is that the stock ways in which people might cluster themselves to get this value overlap seem not on the surface or not by label or category obtainable by the those categories. So just calling yourself an atheist or a Catholic or a whatever, any kind of category that exists in the world, humanitarian, vegetarian, liberal, Republican, whatever, doesn't seem to actually capture the kind of differences or overlaps in conception of the value that you all have just suggested might make that relationship and informed consent easy. Doesn't look so far like you actually have good stand-ins. For example, let's say you say, I'm Catholic, I want a Catholic. Well, that might help if you're both one type of Catholic, card-carrying, toe-the-line on sexuality and conception, reproductive Catholic. Fortunately, though, even, you know, depending on the particular stripe you are, you could even have two priests who aren't equally card-carrying, let alone the rank and file. It's not a good enough stand-in. So you might have a better chance if you're anti-choice, of getting somebody anti-choice, if you both use the word Catholic. On the other hand, your chances of getting somebody who's on the same page with you on birth control are actually very, very slim, because Catholic laity and even some priests, but certainly the Catholic laity, are all over the place on whether one ought to have the pill, not have the pill, only do natural family planning. Just by the fact that you name the word Catholic doesn't say anything about what you think about even permanent forms of birth control like vasectomies or tubal ligation. The Catholic laity doesn't have a uniform view. So just by the fact that and I'll give you an example. My mother-in-law, who's way beyond the age where she has to care about this, sees a Catholic gynecologist. Now, she doesn't have to care about reproduction. She's way too old for it. But she finds this woman's, and so it doesn't matter to her that her gynecologist will not prescribe birth control, will not talk about contraception, has an absolute hard line, not in my office. It doesn't make any difference if you're not actually trying to get reproduction. But my Catholic mother-in-law thinks her Catholic gynecologist is wacky with her 9 children and thinks it's time for the tubal ligation. My Catholic mother-in-law. What's my point? My mass going, novena saying Catholic mother-in-law thinks that the toe-the-line Catholic gynecologist is a fruitcake. So it won't help that the both of them are both Catholics. She thinks this woman ought to get her reproduction under control and use some judgment here, right? Okay, my point, if you can't get it even on that register, how are you going to say, well, being Catholic will help? What do you mean? This woman is very authoritarian about what birth control ought to happen or not happen. That's not going to suit my mother-in-law, even if they were on the same page. The authoritarian part of this woman, even though she's Catholic, wouldn't help because my mother-in-law's not like that. Then when you get to things that can't even be named by membership in a group, how are we actually going to obtain it? So while Veach has an interesting proposal, it doesn't seem like we really have any ways of categorizing ourselves such that we could match up. Maybe, for example, we could take some kind of personality test or values test, and we could sort of match it up that way. But I think at this point, short of that, we don't have any memberships that would actually overlap. And so we're sort of left with the informed consent being really very problematic. Any last thoughts? Then let's us prepare for Turkey Day and call it night.